Hi, how are you? It's June. How is this happening? I don't know how, but it is. In embodying abundance, an interesting sub-thread has been coming out of our time together, and that's time scarcity. There's been a big wave in our course inside of embodying abundance around feeling like there's not enough time. I may or may not do an episode around this down the road, or maybe for our patrons, maybe I will, because it's come up so much. It's come up in my life, my friends' lives, clients' lives, listeners' lives. What I will say for now is this: we can't manage time. We can only manage ourselves in time. Time is going to time. People are going to people. We can only deal with ourselves. And so I've been sharing with folks some ways to reorient into time abundance. And you can ask yourself in your life, if you're feeling like, oh my gosh, how is it June? You can think about managing yourself in time around, one, that which is most important to you, and two, that which restores trust, meaning, and purpose. And you can remember that this is a process where the essential piece is your relationship with yourself. So if you're finding yourself in urgency, how can you slow down energetically? How can you root down into the earth, into the present moment, into your body? Can play with that this week. Speaking of all this time, what is going on our calendar in the Moon Studio? There's one Moon Studio workshop this month. Clear Channels is back. This was such a fun and wonderful series. As soon as I ran it, I knew I'd be doing it again. And so I am. I cannot wait to gather again with folks. Clear Channels is about creating the work that is yours to create and sharing it with the world. There is an emphasis on connecting with folks through your own platforms off of social media. So this includes an emphasis on newsletters, websites, podcasts, as well as finding collaborators through relationship and through real life. And this is the whole thing, I think, about building an authentic business or creative practice. There's this whole like digital marketing bro push around AI and automating and marketing templates and how to go viral or whatever. And I'm not saying that those things are terrible. We certainly want to embrace technology and all of the ways that technology can help us work less, for sure. And also, the kind of business I want to do, and I think you want to do, is authentic and people-based. And if you're listening to this podcast, it's probably spirit and nature-based as well. And that means showing up as yourself, sharing your gifts, and it means relating to other people. Businesses are about our relationships to ourselves and to one another. I've been doing this for a long time, and a high portion of folks who engage with my work intimately. I'm talking about folks who sign up for my in-person live offerings. That's like the most intimate way you can work with me, obviously. I know them. I know you. You know, like they're not some faceless crowd. These are brilliant, cool, interesting people with a lot to offer who I believe in. That's what a service-based and a heart-centered business is for me. Now more than ever, we do have to find ways to connect with our people And now, more than ever, that's easier to do. Clear Channels has this emphasis around sharing your work on a platform you own, a newsletter, your website, and then other channels like YouTube or podcast. These are all the most important things to do. And I believe that probably the most important channel to invest in is a newsletter. My newsletter, without it, I'm pretty positive I would not have a business. And I started it for the same reason I began this podcast, which is that I enjoy it. It's a win-win. You get to share what you care about, what you're obsessed with, your expertise, your opinion in a way that's easy and flows for you. Maybe you share ways that folks can work with you as well. Your authentic sharing creates value, and value creates connection, and connection leads to true relationships. And over time, that is how you grow a sustainable business. If you've been feeling ready to get serious about creating work publicly on, again, a channel or channels that you own, not social media, this offering is for you. If you're ready to share your words, thoughts, and art with the world, but want some guidance and support and structure, this offering is for you. It's online. It will be held over one weekend, June 17th and 18th, and we'll have some follow-up sessions in early July for more implementation. And because I love you, you're a podcast listener, take 13% off with code PODCASTLOVE at checkout. PODCASTLOVE, all one word, gets you 13% off Clear Channels. This is probably the last time I'm offering it this year. I might offer it again in fall if we have interest, but for now, this is it. Okay, let us move on to our show. On today's show, we have very special guest, the one and only Carmen Spagnola. Carmen is a Le Cordon Bleu trained chef, turned trauma recovery practitioner, clinical hypnotherapist, and kitchen witch. She is the author of The Spirited Kitchen, Recipes and Rituals for the Wheel of the Year, host of the Numinous podcast, and founder of the Numinous Network, an online learning and support portal for people healing from trauma through a cross-pollination of somatics, attachment, and nature-based spirituality. This was a great episode. It flows so nicely from the Tower episode we just did into more practice. We talk about larger societal collapse into a nervous system and somatic perspective. That was really important to get into, to think about how this might show up collectively and also in our own wise bodies, our wise animal bodies, who are both messengers and are also doing what they know best, which is to try to keep us safe. And we talk about shifting some of our responses, whether it be hyper or hypo arousal. Carmen also talks about her experience as someone who has lived for decades in a functional stress response, which I know is highly relatable. I suppose the content warning for today's show is that we're talking about hard things, but real things, and we're doing it with levity and from a grounded, hopeful place. Carmen is a light and really grounded in compassion. And also, if you don't want to hear about difficult topics like the climate crisis and so on, now would be the time for you to switch off this episode. This is for you if you're someone who doesn't shy away from difficult topics, if you want to feel less alone in doing so, if you're interested in the intersections between societal collapse, nervous system responses, and also if you want to hear thoughts and ideas from a brilliant, experienced person and practitioner around all of these concepts, which I think you do, here you go. A conversation with the wonderful Carmen Spagnola. Hello, hello, hello. We have the most amazing guest. I have such anticipation because I already know that it's going to be a great conversation because the person I am here with today is a powerhouse, is a multi-hyphenate, has lived many, many lives, is a writer, a facilitator, a nervous system expert, I believe hypnosis facilitator, a teacher, a parent, an artist, and a podcaster. And there's more that I could keep going and going, but I'm going to let this wonderful, wise person introduce themselves as they would like to introduce themselves to listeners of Moonbeaming. We have the wonderful Carmen Spagnola today on the show. Welcome, Carmen.
Thank you, Sarah. I'm so honored to be here. And I feel just all cozy, like I'm just a little mammal. And you just rattled off all these things. And they sound really great. I would say I identify as most of those things. I am a clinical hypnotherapist. I am a somatic trauma practitioner. I am an author. I did write a book called The Spirited Kitchen, Recipes and Rituals for the Wheel of the Year, though I don't identify as writer. I see those things as slightly different. I am a parent. I'm a parent of an amazing child who actually is the real artist. I mean, I am artistic, but my child is an artist. And they identify as gay and anxious. They're an ADHDer, so autism and ADHD, and they are like a full-time artist. When I say full-time, I mean like morning, noon, night, 10 hours a day, drawing, sculpting, that sort of thing. So think of my child as a true artist. And yeah, I am a multi-hyphenate, I'm multi-passionate, but ultimately I'm just a little mammal, just doing my thing, just a little bean here, trying to survive in late stage racialized capitalism, and actually having not a bad go of it. I try to enjoy my time while I'm here, you know.
I sure do know. I wanted you to lead us, if you feel called, with consent. I would love for you to lead us in a gentle grounding technique that you employ to center and reconnect to the present moment, if you would like to.
Sure, I would love to. I am a person who politicizes my practice. And what I mean by that is that just multiple times a day, I am locating myself. Where am I? What am I doing? And so I do land acknowledgements at the beginning of all my sessions, but I also do them throughout the day. And I really try to let people know this is not a somatic practice, even though it may have somatic benefit, but it's what I do before my somatic practices. And I've taken guidance from Hayden King, who's an Anishinaabe scholar, who wrote a very well-known op-ed in one of Canada's national papers critiquing land acknowledgements, how they're just a thing we can do to kind of, you know, for those of us who are settlers, who are white, we just check it off to kind of make ourselves feel better. And what he asked is, now that you've acknowledged the land, what does that mean? So how then shall you proceed? How does that impact you? And so before I do any kind of practice where I'm going to try to ground or, you know, ask the land to support me in feeling more safe and secure, I like to locate myself. So the first thing I'd invite folks to do is just take a moment to like look out the window or feel your feet or just think about it. Whose land are you on? So I'm joining from the lands of the Lekwungen-speaking peoples. Those are the Songhees and the Esquimalt First Nations. It's recently known as Victoria, BC. There are actually several nations within just half an hour from here who all speak different languages, who also stewarded this land in the past and continue to today. So where I grew up an hour away from here is Hulkamilam and Hulkamilam speaking land. And I learned about this sort of way of thinking about whose land I'm on through language groups by taking Lekwungen language lessons at the Songhees Nation Center. Where I live, you could call it Coast Salish territory, but there's actually like 60 different distinct languages within Coast Salish nations. So wow. That's just in one area of like British Columbia, Pacific Northwest. And I think about that as so instructive for those of us who are working somatically. We're trying to connect across difference and not even having the same language. Mm-hmm. They were able to do so much with like 7 different language groups within an hour of where I live. So that's where I am. And then I like to take a moment to acknowledge what I bring to where I am. So what identities and lineages I carry. So settler identities are a very important identity to me. I've been really transformed by going through the personal process of attending Truth and Reconciliation Commission hearings in 2012. It's changed how I parent, how I partner, how I show up in community. Nonetheless, this is a main identity that I carry where I am. I'm cis, I'm mostly straight, I'm able-bodied. And then I take a moment to listen to the land. So I sort of go, okay, so what am I doing? So I'm about to do some grounding and I'm going to ask the land to support me. So I want to be in right relationship. And that can be, you can think of that as a political stance. I'm also an animist. So I think of that as my spiritual practice. So I just take a moment to listen, given where I am, given who I am and what I carry here, given what I'm endeavoring to do. How can I be where I am in a good way? How can we all be together in a good way? And then if I really tune in, okay, so here's what I'm trying to do. And I'm connecting with people through airwaves and in different times and space across different dimensions. I think because I know that what's in my heart is a theme of collapse. It's very alive for me. I was teaching about collapse earlier today. I'm talking about large-scale cooperation dilemmas for which there are no solutions can really overwhelm folks. I'm talking about the collective freeze response that we experience in late-stage racialized capitalism. And so whenever I know I'm going to talk about that, I try to remind people to bring on your arms and legs. It's that simple. So I do a lot of like making fists and stretching my hands, wiggling my toes. I do a lot of pressing my heels into the floor to kind of feel my sit bones and send signals to my brain that I have legs. And I'll often press my feet into the floor so that I can feel some pressure up the sympathetic chain, up my spine, pressure at my back. Mm. And then another thing I do is I tap my finger to the center of my upper lip. And I feel how I can sense that around my eyes, my nose, my temples, my cheeks. Mm. So it's almost like I'm sending Morse code to my ventral vagal, my social engagement nervous system, to be like, hey, buddy, like we're here, we're together. I'm here with Sarah. I'm connecting through the airwaves with all these other folks. And I'm not alone. And there are people who get me. My words are going to land somewhere. And those are practices that I would encourage folks to employ if stuff is coming up that I'm saying that just feels, I don't know, it can feel kind of harsh or it can feel like abrupt or arresting, you know, kind of a rude awakening to be like, what is this collapse person talking about? What does that even mean?
We're definitely going to talk about it. So we're going to talk more about collapse. I just wanted to reflect back. One, and I've shared this before in other places, gentle listeners, but I'm going to share it again. For a lot of people, or some people, who are in a state of freeze / denial slash, you know, inability to be open to certain aspects of reality, the truth can feel very harsh. And the truth can feel like an attack, specifically if we've been, some people have been coddled, not necessarily by our parents or our caretakers or even many of our relationships, but coddled by an overculture that promises us the dream, the happily ever after, the staying out of harm, the, well, you didn't do this or whatever. And I love this practice that you brought forth and these ideas, because it does require us to be in our window or be in some form of capacity. And that, as you know, this is what you do for a job. You know that it's going to look different. It's going to look different from you now, right now, as it might 4 days from now when you're trying to get your kid to bed or whatever. It's just, it's flux, and there's no bad or good, right? It's not like, oh, you're better than or whatever, mm-hmm. right? So let's just all sweep all these assumptions away for the time being. Mm-hmm. But I do think it's important. What I love just being in this space with you, I love how I can co-regulate with you as you sink into your presence and aliveness and the complexities of the experience that you're noticing and bringing forth. And that allows me to co-regulate more and tune in with myself, which then allows me to be open to you, which then creates, you know, this ripple and all of it. And it's just very skillful, I think. I think that if we want to build skill in living in a present embodied way, we have to open up to like the complexity. And another theme I have been talking about quite a lot this year, because it's a chariot year and it brings up ideas of ambivalence. I can't white savior my way into being good or into completely fixing everything, but I can check in with my capacity and I can make a promise to show up in an aligned way to the best of where I'm at with what I have in order to be in a more aligned, ego-less space with my space. And it just looks so different in terms of where everyone's at. For people who can leave their house, it could be picking up garbage. It could be community gardens. I'm privileged enough to have a garden of my own. I definitely plant native and really think about working with the soil as land. And also for me, because it's part of my practice, I'll give money. I give any time I'm doing something where I am partnering with the land. Anytime I hold space for people, which is anytime I hold space for people, a portion of those slots go to Indigenous-led land steward projects that are local. And there are so many, and listeners can look up their land tax. There's many in America. I don't know if there are in Canada, but there's land tax. And if you don't have one in your state, there could be one nearby. There is most certainly an Indigenous-led organization of some kind on any level, most likely in every state in the United States. Don't quote me, but find the one over from you. Find the one three over from you. And the other thing I'm just going to say, and then I'll get off my microphone and allow you beautiful mammal to have the microphone for a bit, is I always encourage other white people who have the capacity and who have the means and who have the motivation to do something just out of their comfort zone in regards to reciprocity, right? Oh, I don't have time to do the land cleanup. Could you go for 2.5 hours? You know, or whatever, right? Like just a little bit, because I know for me, I have to be mindful of where comfort meets expansion. And often if I can titrate and just go a little bit, little by little, oh, okay, we're not forcing, we're not pressuring, but yeah, that's all I have to say on that.
It's so useful though. That place where like comfort meets complacency as well. Like in my work, we're talking a lot about dosing the field with safeness and attuning to our own preferences and not pushing through signs of distress, and how that is a practice of unhooking from capitalist, imperialist, white supremacist patriarchy, which has conditioned us to push through signs of distress in our nervous system. At the same time, there is a little place where we recognize, oh, I'm actually immobilized. I'm anesthetized right now. And just a tiny bit of mobilization can help. So just like eyes forward, facing forward. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even it could be just something like Googling. Like, yes, in Canada, we have reciprocitytrust.ca. If you want to look at land tax going to your local Indigenous nations, I donate to RAVEN, which is a British Columbia organization that puts funds towards the legal battles for sovereignty here. So those are the kinds of things that they're a little arm's length. They're one little thing you can do. When it comes to engaging with those more challenging things like collapse, which is a overwhelming global high activation topic, because it's a global high activation phenomenon. What we want to do is we want to contain, and we want to have containers. And one thing I would say is, like, to the folks who feel like, oh my God, it's so overwhelming, I can't even get into this, I do want to say that we are in it. And the thing about collapse awareness is that it settles anxiety to a certain extent. We're always dancing between too much urgency and too much complacency. But for some folks, just hearing the truth spoken is very regulating. And then for the folks who are like, oh my gosh, this is like oxygen for me. Give me more. Tell me more. I want to say that competence is very grounding and clarity is very settling. So having a sense of we're not going to solve these problems. These are not problems to be solved. They're predicaments that we can only respond to. Mm-hmm. And although there's a strong cultural, let's call it a cultural meme about beans and bunkers and like protecting them, that's not what collapse is. Collapse is something we're in right now. And there's the things you do, but then there's the way you be. There's the manner of approach. And it's the manner of approach that includes self and co-regulation, includes also satisfiability and enoughness and the small and delicious life, all this stuff, right? It's so good. It's so rich. And
I just finished recording about enoughness and the ability to be satiated and nourished. And so I'm just sorry to interrupt. Yes. Keep going. And you will say.
Absolutely. I will also say, I also think there's a place in this discourse for morality, that there is something about knowing what our values are and reaching towards what we care about and naming that as a moral compass that is very empowering. Mm-hmm. And we can look to teachers like Viktor Frankl or Hannah Arendt and realize that even in the face of these overwhelmingly dire circumstances, we can still be moral actors. And I think in Western culture anyway, it's sort of almost like evangelical Christianity feels like they've cornered the market on morality, or we say things like the morality police in a really derogatory way. But I think that there are immeasurable benefits to being in touch with your values and your integrity and your honor and your dignity. It gives you self-esteem and self-love, and it does give you just this wealth of joy and the joy is so much more accessible when you know who you are, what you care about. And then even beyond that, there's a radiance that comes from knowing who you are and what you care about. It's very attractive and it will attract your people to you. So I think that there is some security in the communal aspect of being able to grapple with topics that are difficult like this.
All of the nods. Listeners cannot see me. I am nodding and nodding and nodding so much. It's just an aside. And then I want to ask you more questions. Actually, no, I think it'll be a question for you because I think you've thought about this. The least listened to episodes on this podcast are in the title are ethics and values. And I have my reasons, as you've said, of why, especially if you are a spiritual practitioner who works with energy, B, someone who holds space for any other person, C, someone who maybe wasn't taught certain truths or certain ways of being aligned with integrity. One, why do you think there is sometimes an avoidance or freeze or collapse around issues of value and how of being in right relationship and accountability and all of those themes?
Well, I think we live in a very misanthropic culture. Like we live in a culture that has the audacity to say things like humans are a scourge on the earth, or, you know, we suck, or people are garbage, or trash, or whatever. And like, I get it. That's just like pop culture jargon in some way. But I do think that generally we are conditioned by hateful systems. The overculture is hateful of humans and little mammals. And so, of course, we will feel under attack. It has all the same makings of any cult, right? Where it's like, you know, if folks haven't heard of Alexandra Stain's work, the book Terror, Love, and Brainwashing, Disorganized Attachment and Totalitarian Regimes, it's fabulous.
Because it's an easy read. It's a beach read.
I have so many book darts and post-it notes in it. But actually, it's super fascinating. And really, it's about how our overculture is a cult. And that's the cult of capitalism. That's the cult of whiteness. And so in the same way that a cult or a high demand community appeals to our higher values as a human, in the very next breath, there is shaming, there is blaming, there is that, again, it's like misanthropic, like you are failing or you are shit or whatever. And so I think it's pretty fair to be afraid to face these things. I also think that in the last decade, so I'm Gen X. I graduated in 1993, where we just started getting the internet like in school, right? It was like MS-DOS or whatever it was. And yeah. I was in university before I got my first electronic email. So I'm not like a millennial who has grown up being perceived online. Mm-hmm. But I think if you grow up being perceived online, you have witnessed people being dragged. And sometimes it's very valid and other times it's really inhumane. So I think it's very fair that folks will have experienced like vicarious trauma of seeing somebody make mm-hmm. a mistake in public. The only way I have figured out how to overcome that terror, that fear of the mob, is to fiercely embrace, like almost like a defense response, making mistakes in public and being like, okay, wow, I super fucked up there. Like, would anybody yeah. like to gather and talk about this? Or like, I really do try to say, yeah. oh, I used to do things this way and now I do it that way. Oh, yeah. I used to be a person, you know? So I think that's a very helpful place to start, is kind of acknowledging, like, I personally don't want to be misanthropic. I don't want to be human hating. I don't want to do that. I want to move through the world assuming that everyone's doing the best they can. And if they could do better, they would. And mm-hmm. so then when we engage in these topics of ethics and morality and right relationship, it can go a little easier. I've also tapped into communities very different from what I ever grew up with or ever experienced, that were intergenerational. So not only Indigenous elders, well, I certainly have like close relationships and mentor relationships and have for many years, but also with like Quaker elders. You know, I'm not Christian, but where I live, you can have a liberal, unplanned Quaker meeting. And so you don't have to believe in Jesus. You don't have to be Christian. And basically, I got like the superhero Justice League of like elderly second wave feminist mentors that were with me. And I could feel in their nervous systems that they had been through some shit. And that, you know, all of us are going to live long enough to see our ideas, our best ideas, our ways of life become passé. And, you know, and so that helps me resource that it's like, you know, I'm just learning. And I do think having a sense of my moral compass is really important. And some of the things I used to believe, I don't believe anymore, but I still believe in the pursuit of being a moral actor. And I still believe that there is a biological rightness to being in a right relationship and mutuality and reciprocity with other beings, including the other than human beings. And so I think morals and ethics are a great place to lean on. I think I'm also a bit of a nerd for it because when I was in grade 11, I read The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People by Stephen Covey, who I know is a Mormon, but still I like totally stand by that. And I listened to all of his tapes, stuff like that. So I had a very strong sense of moral compass, not because I grew up that way. I grew up in a household with, you know, really, really terrible racism and classism and ableism and fat phobia and all of that. I wasn't like raised in like a moral container. Maybe that's a benefit though. I've been seeking it and hungry for it. I've always had a highly developed spiritual yearning, but I think also underneath that at the core is I have always wanted a moral compass that I could be proud of.
That's so beautiful. I'm thinking about so many things you said. There's this great Brian Massumi quote that says something to the effect of, ethics are what we create so that we can be together in the unknown. And I love that idea, which is one of generosity, which is one of co-creation. There are things I've said probably 1 year ago that I don't agree with, right? And I'm always learning and I'm always growing. And I think a real hallmark of humanity is being able to transform and being able to change your mind and being able to apologize, be accountable, and make that apology real by changing your actions long term and letting other people know, you know, saying, oh, hey, did you know that term is da da da? I didn't know. But now here's a link, like maybe you want to change your landing page or whatever, right?
Yeah.
There's always little things you can do. And for me, like a spiritual practice is really the practice of not taking things personally because people don't always react. What I have found is that there are three responses. And then it's where I want to talk to you about collapse. There are three responses. There are, oh, thank you. Or like, right? Like, thanks. Thanks a lot. There are pure vitriol and anger, like, how dare you? And then there's just total like ignoring. And then there's like a spectrum of ignoring, which includes like blocking you. Like, you know, like it's like, okay, instant. All right, not open. And so I have been a little bit more, I still email people and things like that. I try to be as loving and human as possible. I never was not, but I can understand. Someone said to me that like, people tend to read messages in their own voice, and a lot of people's own voices are very critical and very judgmental. So to be almost extra heart emoji when you're, you know, talking to someone. But
that is great advice.
I want to talk about collapse because you want to talk about collapse. Carmen, what is collapse?
In a nutshell.
Where you are today, how you are today, how you're being with yourself today, how you're being with collapse, let us know.
Collapse in a nutshell is looking at the converging emergencies of large-scale cooperation dilemmas and the impacts of living with problems that don't have solutions. So when I say a cooperation dilemma, the pandemic response is a perfect example. We've all just lived through it. What an interesting insight now into how we are going to handle cooperation dilemmas. Public health is a classic cooperation dilemma. But we can keep going up the scales. When we're talking about large-scale cooperation dilemmas, we can look at, you know, how are we going to live in society? Are we going to continue on with white supremacy? Are we going to continue on with human supremacy is where I'd like to be at, but we're not there yet. We can look at climate change and however many decades the COP meetings have been going on. So these are large-scale cooperation dilemmas. And at a certain point in every civilization's history, they will meet a point of diminishing returns on complexity. So we solve these dilemmas by adding solutions that are usually technical solutions. We add vaccines, we add, you know, and then we discover, oh shit, there's increasing vaccine injury, or oh damn it, there's, you know, not enough for everyone, or oh, of course, we didn't distribute them equally, or long COVID, what are we going to do? All of these things are cooperation dilemmas happening at very large scales. And where I'm at today is, okay, so this was good data. If we're not all going to agree to adopt very low barrier, low tech supports, you know, just very basic measures like masking and physical distancing, or ventilation, which is more complex, but at least not a personal issue. If we're not going to do that, then we have very good data now about how we're going to muddle through our climate crises, cooperation dilemmas. And so where that leaves me is refocusing once again on local structures instead of global ones. People will often then be like, oh, God damn it. But I live in this city, or I don't know people, or I don't, you know, there's all these sort of cascading things about, well, how are we going to survive in constant crises if we don't get it together and avert these crises? And the sort of good news and the bad news is, so we're not going to avert them. That's the hard truth that we could all face. And once we do that, we can now withdraw our resources, our time, our money, our energy from things that are futile. And futility, any attachment parent will tell you this, or any attachment therapist will remind you that futility is a gateway to grief. And once you can really engage with your grief, then vitality can return. When we're in a state of holding and gripping and bracing against an inevitable reality or a thing that has happened, we are spending a lot of our time, energy, attention on trying to conjure unreality. Futility, recognizing futility, is a physiological response where we finally stop bracing. We stop bracing and we let whatever the stress is, however it wants to come out, come through. That could be wailing. That could be kicking and screaming. That could be breaking things. That could be really like tantrum for a long time. It could be depression. And over time, if in that space, we can dose the field with a high degree of contact nutrition. So that's soothing words, that safe touch, that's kind eyes, that's shared rhythms, that's being in space together, that's eating and drinking together. What will happen is finally a settling, and then the next piece, which is mobilization, we kind of get a little inspired. We get a little like, okay, the thing I've been bracing against that stuck all that energy has left, and now vitality wants to rush in and take its place. And in that vitality rushing in and taking its place, we can find the strength to say, so then how shall we live? How then shall we proceed in a moral way or in a connected way or in a beautiful way? Because guess what? We are in collapse now, but babies and puppies and kittens keep being born, and like horses keep being their majestic selves, and we keep, you know, falling in love and being horny for people, and we keep like achieving milestones, and these beautiful things keep happening. People keep being born, people keep dying, life remains poignant. And in that space, we can then refocus then on those local structures of community, of land tending, of living simply, living frugally, cultivating enoughness and satisfiability, ritualizing where we are, conserving culture and craft, and cultivating earth-honoring spirituality, moving into right relationship with those larger benefic forces that still exist and I think are championing our cause.
Yeah, I heard somewhere, I was listening to a podcast between Bjork and the author who wrote Braiding Sweetgrass.
Robin Wall Kimmerer.
Thank you. I always confuse her name with Robin Rose Bennett just because my brain doesn't work well that way. Thank you for correcting. And she was saying that they did a study that bird song enhanced and increased people's joy and happiness. And so I took a moment to tune into the birds outside of your window as you're talking about this complexity. And I wanted to ask you, as someone who is very skillful and practiced at upregulating, maybe downregulating, I know that this is going to resonate. I know that the correlations between aspects of reality and the body and the collapse in the body and the collapse in the world is going to resonate with so many. And everyone is different where they are. I'm resonating with that. I was like, oh yes, of course. This is why I've been so in hypo and freeze, where normally I'm a fighter and a flighter. Like my whole life, I've been a fighter and a flighter. And then the last couple of years, I'm like, what is this? Like, I'm like, oh, it's freeze response. What could practices, because this is the other issue, right? Because these are questions I get all the time. I'm really overwhelmed. What's one little thing I can do? I'm super flooded. I know you do this in part for a living, or you've done this for a living. I know you have your own classes and courses around this. For folks who are feeling somatically in collapse, I'd love it if you could describe some what that might feel like for some people, not everybody, but what that tends to feel like and be like, and just what are some ways that we can shift?
I would love to, Sarah, because as a person who lived in functional freeze for like 35 years, it really is stunning then afterwards when you have much more access to sensing body and stress levels and things like that. It's like, oh, right. Okay. So that there's many different kinds of freeze. Some people are in more of like an alert, attentive kind of freeze, deer in headlights. You are tracking threat. You're being very still, but you are tracking and you are like, boom, very clear. Some people are in that, like you described, kind of a more hypo-aroused type of freeze where it's very foggy. It's like they're in the fog and they can't quite access themselves or others. Maybe they'll hear us outside the fog being like, I see you, I'm here, do you need tea? But like, it's hard to reach. And then there are those of us who have lived in functional freeze. And I often think of it as like, I'm kind of like a whirling dervish. I'll be getting so much shit done. I'll be like cleaning my house when I'm upset or angry. But really, my mind is very far off. It's in some place way advanced, many steps ahead of me, or way in the past. I'm still having a conversation shouting at somebody from 15 years ago, whatever. And yet my body is go, go, go. And it's not until I hurt myself, I bump into something, my vestibular system goes off, or there's some kind of like pressure that comes out, a migraine, a panic attack, breaking a treasured object, those kinds of things that I'm like, oh, wow, I am like really not in contact with myself. It's been a long time since I experienced that, but I share that so that folks have a sense that there's a huge spectrum within freeze. One of my sort of signature postures in freeze is I just call it schlumpy. So like if you've lost all tone, your like shoulders are like curled in, your chin's like out, or your head's off to the side, and like you're like the letter C. You're just like, you know, it's like, okay. So mm-hmm. we all have experienced different forms of collapse, whether it's through loss or disappointment or pandemic isolation. That schlumpiness and losing tone in our core is kind of a telltale sign of like, oh, we're kind of losing it here. And so I will often just go into that collapse shape and just go, okay, I'm going to consciously collapse for a second here. So sitting in a chair, I just let myself get all schlumpy, slumping over, and I go until I sense, oh, this isn't good. Now, some people will slump and be like, ah, the void, it beckons to me. And they'll just want to like go into it. In which case it's like, okay, but the exercise is, can I resist the void? Some people might get panicked and be like, oh, no, I don't like this feeling. I don't like it at all. And so what we do is we press through the heels, and you press through the heels, you activate the psoas, the muscle group at the low back, you put some pressure on the mid back and the upper back, and you actually look up and you scan for safeness. So you are just looking for something that makes you feel good. And when you get it, then you try to rest in a state of well-being for a few breaths. And when I do this with clients where I'm like, okay, so you're looking at this object, how do you know that it makes you feel good? Like maybe your eyes water, your mouth water. For me, like my head will tilt, I'll get a little Mona Lisa smile. And then I'll say to them, okay, so rest there, just like breathe in that and like tell me when something changes, when it shifts, just give me like, okay, it's shifted. And then after a little pause, sometimes they're like, okay, it's shifted. And I'm like, okay, great. So that was like 7 seconds. And what we want to do is we want to keep practicing until we can rest in a state of well-being for maybe more like 2 minutes. Because it takes about 2 minutes to have a neuroplastic event where your brain is rewiring and like, oh, that's a resource for me. I could recruit that in the future. If I just know where this neural pathway is, I could like get myself to look and like throw to a ballast to help stabilize myself right now. So that's something that I would do. And I would say that the more you can practice noticing little tiny, just the shape of collapse, and doing that practice when you're not totally in it, that will be helpful for you because of that neural pathway. Before I had all these practices, I would talk about going into the concrete box, which was like I'd be in conflict with my partner. He's more anxious. I'm more avoidant. We both earned secure attachment, but let's just say that's how it was. And he'd be talking, pursuing, signal cry, trying to like get my attention. And I would literally be falling asleep because I felt like I was in a concrete box with no doors and windows and no oxygen. I wasn't thinking anything. He'd be like, why aren't you saying anything? What are you thinking? And literally it was like it was like a flat line inside. I have no thoughts.
Yeah. You just feel like I need to conserve all my energy. Yeah.
Exactly. Long term. And so it's not when you're in that you're going to be able to get yourself out. If you're already in the concrete box, you're going to have to just wait it out pretty much. You're going to have to like wait for time or circumstance to change so that the oxygen comes back, you can bring yourself back. That's just biology. There's no moral failure in not being able to pull yourself out of a concrete box. But if you can do that thing where you change your shape, you intentionally scan for safeness, and you try to take in like a teaspoon more, and that becomes your practice, you will get better and better at being able to mobilize out of your freeze. The thing is, though, I want to say, like, no harm, no foul to all of us for being in collective freeze, because you know, it's almost a cliche. Whatever put you into freeze, you're going to have to experience when you come out of freeze. So the question really is, what are you coming out of freeze into? What are you coming out of freeze into? So if there's no good thing to land in, like people who are like, yeah, collapse, dude, hearing you, it's a real thing. Yeah. If you don't have anything to come out into, then like you can't blame people for staying frozen. There's no good alternative. Yes. And so, you know, is it complacency or is it just a massive collective trauma response and like genuine powerlessness? If you are like trying to vote a certain way and protest a certain way and raise awareness a certain way, and like it still isn't working because you live in a sham of a democracy, then that's not complacency. That's just genuine powerlessness. And you can't blame people for mm-hmm. getting overwhelmed by that. So it requires different tactics, but that's something I would say for everybody. It's like you come out of your collapse shape, but what are you coming out into? So that's why you got to dose the field with safeness, objects, beings other than human kin that get you, people that get you, that kind of thing.
When I teach protection magic, and I know you're a practitioner of, you know, ritual and craft, I often say you can try to co-regulate with nature. Find a spot in your home, maybe it's your bed if you live alone, that you can make your haven and that you can make your safe space. And you might want to bring in textures and colors. And if you are a practitioner of witchcraft or any other kind and this appeals to you, you can bring in smell. We know that smell really helps us recalibrate. It connects to one of the oldest parts of our brain. So I'll often, like when I teach classes, I don't get nervous, but like I don't get ungrounded in classes, but sometimes I'll just smell my little essential oil like a forking freak just to, and I suggest people if they're tapping, whether they're getting out of a state or they're down regulating or just tapping to do their affirmations, to use some kind of scent they really enjoy, to bring in correspondences like, you know, stones can work or certain plants from their yard or something like that, that they can be in some kind of connection with that feels believable. Because I love, love, love what you brought up. If you're in a household of stress or you step outside your door and it's very conflict ridden, yeah, it's going to be harder, not impossible, but it'll be certainly more challenging paired with this awesome coping mechanism that your body created for you to deal that you're used to. So I love that you said that. And I'm wondering if you wanted to share some of your craft practices that intersect with these more somatic practices that might have helped you or help you or that you recommend or that bring you kind of back to that ventral vagus that we all have come to know and love.
Totally. Well, yeah, big props to temperature and aroma for being like the absolute, just they're the magic potions, temperature and aroma. I right now have a very warm, very heavy hot water bottle in my lap. And I also keep aromatherapy all over the place. And I use that quite a bit in my craft. So I have a daily practice of planetary propitiations, which I've had for a long time, but wasn't very consistent in. And I take this from Erin Fairchild from Journal as Altar, where she says, I have a daily journaling practice that I don't do every day. Yeah. And I just love the permission of that. However, since about September, maybe late August 2022, I've been pretty like every day on my planetary magic. And one of the things I do like to do, tying into aroma, is build up a fragrance with a drop of a different essential oil every day of the week. And by the end of the week, when I get to Sunday or Saturday, sometimes I kind of think of Saturn as like anchoring my week. It's so rich. It's so full. And I just feel like my crew is around me and it feels like the air is alive with all of the planets that I've been working with and the deities associated with them. I think my ancestral veneration practice has been probably the anchor or like the centerpiece of my co-regulation with spirit. I have an ancestor tree where it seems like maybe, I don't know, 9 years ago or so, it seemed like my ancestors kind of like took up residence in it, this big tree in the yard. And I was learning Gaelic, Scottish Gaelic death laments and keening at the time. And that sense of feeling moved and trusting that I was meant to follow that in my practice gave me a lot of confidence. And then one day I sang this tune to my teacher, and she had taught me the lyrics. I learned the lyrics from her, but I was like, you know, I've lost the tune. I think it goes like this. And we were doing this over Zoom. And I sang it to her, and then, like, it's so funny because I listened to it in a recording afterwards, and it was like so different, the tune that I sang. But she said, so that's not quite the tune, but the old ones are singing through you. So you should follow that. That's your tune. That's your song. That's your ancestral sound. You should follow that. So I try to trust that my ancestors are guiding me. And whenever I feel like I can't break through in the human level with my child or with my partner, I do a lot of calling in of my ancestors as competent protectors. Not so much the ancestors whose names I know from history, because, you know, we're all downstream from a couple world wars and a lot of intergenerational trauma and displacement and persecution. We all have victim and perpetrator ancestors. I kind of like hop over that, and I work with what feels more like the oversoul of a lineage. And I have a felt sense of what it's like when the oversoul of that lineage, when those ancestors come to me, it's a very distinct somatic sensation. And it has like a very, like, it moves top to bottom, back to front, right to left, like it kind of like whooshes over me. And that really empowers my magic. That's like a yes signal for me. So yeah, I would say that, like, being in my garden is a big part of it too. It was like a huge revelation to me when I realized that I don't just love old English roses. Like, of course I love them and I tend them and I have like intense interest and I study quite a bit. But once I realized, oh wait, it's their medicine. Like, I love them and I think they love me. Oh, and yeah. I feel so loved. I was like really moved by that. That I was like, wow, I feel so blessed. I feel so loved. I feel so seen as the me that's just enthusiastic and like wide-eyed in wonder. And I get these very, well, I mean, this is the ventral vagal, right? This is why awe is so good for the vagus nerve. It inspires pro-social behavior where I want to like connect with, but also collaborate with and be enfolded into something greater than myself. So when I'm enfolded into rose medicine, I feel part of it and I'll sacrifice myself for it. So then when I access a bit of rose medicine in essential oils or whatever, I feel my ecological self come alive, the self that's woven into all the other things. And I feel belonging on the earth and I feel a part, and I know what my role is. It's to be myself as much as I can. So that empowers my magic quite a bit.
Also rose fan. I have 3 rose bushes. I would love a whole, you know, garden of them. Flowers remind us to be ourselves because they cannot be anything other than themselves. And they are in their own world with each other, with plant companions and the soil and their transmissions and their unique scents and all of it. And I also love thinking about roses as being a specific flower that truly does like need us to cultivate her. Even though she sort of has that cat vibe of like, you know, let me be, you know, like my roses in my garden don't really want to be picked. Like I visit them every morning and smell them and like tell them how beautiful they are. But they're like, yeah, no, we just want to stay where we are. And I'm like, okay, I'll respect that for you. I wanted to also, with your ancestral practice, I'm sure that food is a part of that as well. And I was hoping you could share about how that food practice wove its way into the beautiful book that you created.
Well, food affirms life. That is sort of my guiding principle. Food affirms life. Anytime I do magic, that seems like the very next natural thing to do is I want to eat something and ingest and let that magical thing that just happened become my blood, my skin, my fat cells, my eyelashes, my hair, my nails. You know, I love that experience of absorbing magic through food. So that connection between a desire to honor the earth. You know, I grew up, you know, a 90s teen who was growing up with like the ozone layer depleting and that sort of thing. So like, that was a big deal for me. Earth Day as a young person felt like a real cause. And that desire to be in right relationship with the land, I think, is a natural starting place for our animism. But we come up against another cooperation dilemma if we eat food as an animist. Whether you're eating meat or plants, it's like it's not a vegan or not question. If you're an animist, you don't believe in a hierarchy of consciousness. So you don't really think about that eating beef or eating a cow is actually any worse really than eating the rose that you've just been pledging love to and, you know, loves you. And so this is where we can practice our intersectionality. This is where we can bring that discernment and right relationship into our craft. And I think food is one of the ways we can affirm our lives, affirm our values, connect with those larger benefic energy flows and energies of the cosmos, and also prepare ourselves. I think of eating and cooking not only as, you know, it's almost a cliche to be like, food is love, you know, it's like water for chocolate, right? Like emotion gets conveyed through its story, tradition, but also food is death practice. It is a practice for grief literacy and death literacy and an acknowledgement that one day I will be food. I will be food, and I want to be good food. I want the earth to feel like, ah, here comes our daughter returning, and she is going to bring with her good nutrients. You know, like I want my presence to be that as well. And particularly what I know as a somatic trauma practitioner, as someone who is intensely interested in the vagus nerve, if we know that ingestion behaviors like eating and drinking are one of the ways that we co-regulate, think about how hard it is to digest if you arrive at the table and it's stressful. I grew up hating the dinner table. I hated the dinner table. I grew up with a stepdad who hated me. It was like very clear from the time I was 5 years old. No wonder I was constipated until I was like 35 or whatever. No wonder I don't get hunger signals. No wonder I can go until 4 p.m. without eating. So it has taken a long time for me to recognize that, like, essentially my diaphragm had like pinched off, and like the vagus, my gut brain could not communicate to my cranial brain. That freeze was like on all the time. So, you know, my parasympathetic nervous system didn't rest and digest for a long time. So it felt really important for me, having recognized this and realizing that I wanted to come to the table and have that place where people had good food, not just in the eating of it, in honoring my ancestors with the foods that they lived on and eating in my bioregion, but I also wanted their nervous systems to be able to feel calm and settled. I wanted everyone to feel seen. It was difficult because my teenager has exactly what I had as a teen, misophonia. So like extreme rage triggered by sound, and mine is specifically around like eating and stuff. And so is my child.
Chewing. Yeah,
totally. So I had this like whole dream as a parent who was like practicing attachment and trauma recovery that we would have like beautiful meals and like conversation. And it turned out what we learned is like, nope, that's our silent time. Earplugs in for my kiddo. So we do our socializing before very often. and will socialize maybe with like a drink or something like that. But like, it's in a totally different kind of way. There's a lot more space. We're not so close. We do our talking and socializing and conviviality almost like happy hour. And then like there's a little break. And then we like eat quietly and calmly. And then afterwards, everybody like rests and digests. And I feel like there's so many linkages between healing my ancestral wounds of trauma and being able to come to the table, not just eating the food, but doing it in a good way, doing it in a calm way, doing it in a way that we can actually integrate the blessings of the lineage. That's just so different from how I ever grew up. And I think that that's something that I hope to keep expanding on in my work as I keep teaching folks about contact nutrition and how important ingestion behaviors are in terms of connecting with each other and feeling like we're getting well fed. Not only am I feeling fullness signals in my belly, but like my mind feels like full in a good way and my heart feels full in a good way. That's what I want for folks.
And that all came through in your gorgeous book that people can get just about anywhere. Carmen, I could talk to you forever. I feel like we just got started. I know you have your own podcast. We'll put all of these links in the show notes. I'd love it if you could just share for folks who would love to work with you, how they can work with you, where they can find you. I know there are going to be hundreds of people who are just like, yes, I need more. I mean, I can't get enough. I'm like, how can I work with you? Let us all know.
I have actually made it so simple because I have so many courses. I've been teaching courses for a long time. I've been teaching like since Zoom was like a pretty new thing. So I have to say the pandemic did me a huge favor because I've been teaching, you know, several classes a month through Zoom since 2014. That's also the time that my podcast started, the Numinous podcast. So the way to work with me is to join the Numinous network and then you get all the stuff. So all of my on-demand courses, I have several attachment courses. There's one that's about contact nutrition very specifically. And it's more of a like, we're not going to like, you don't have to go deep. It's like you just get the psychoeducation of how to co-regulate with people. Like, how do you work with the vagus nerve so that you feel and you can engender in someone else that sense of being safe, seen, secure, and soothed. Then if you want to like really get into like nerding out on not only attachment and polyvagal theory, but also power, rank, and privilege in attachment, positionality in attachment, which like does not come up in a lot of dating attachment books, then I have an on-demand course called Secure, the Magical Art and Subtle Science of Attachment. Those things are all available in the Numinous Network. Just like, and I also have my Intro to Tarot and my Pendulum Primer, just a ton of courses. But then the real signature of the Numinous Network is it's kind of, think of it as like a YMCA membership, or like, I guess for some people, like a yoga studio or something. So we have a calendar of live events. In April, there's like 44 live events. So every month we have anywhere from like 30 to 45 live things. And that is somatics, group somatics, like embodied attachment, where we do these exercises. I also offer things like the Safe and Sound Protocol from Stephen Porges. We have like live calls on that. We do a lot of jams. Like attachment jams. We just talked about attachment. We're doing perimeno jam for perimenopausal folks. We also have a sensitive systems and long COVID connection group. So that's for folks who have any kind of dysautonomia, any autoimmunity, people who have POTS or MCAS or chronic fatigue or Ehlers-Danlos. They're just like, ding, ding, ding. Yes, there is a space where people come together and not only share resources and witnessing, but we are also incorporating, like, how do you do collapse or pandemic living or those kinds of things? We rely on each other a lot to be able to speak the same language about those things. So anyway, the Numinous Network, that's kind of the one way to work with me. It's the one-stop shop. And it's a very, like, there's no high-pressure thing. So we have a lot of people who, like, join for a month in the summer or 2 months in the summer because they have a bit more time and then they quit. And then they come back in December because we do the Spirit of Yuletide and that's like a big deal there. And that's also where like, so a lot of people find the Spirited Kitchen, my book, and it's set up with the 8 micro seasons of the year, the Wheel of the Year. We had the live events in the Numinous Network. So that's where the Spirited Kitchen really comes alive. So it's, you know, it's like a one-stop shop and there's lots of very cool people and people should come check it out.
Amazing. It was so wonderful to be here with you. Thank you so much for your generosity and your wisdom and your you-ness. Thank you so much.
I'm so honored to be here. Thanks for the invitation, Sarah. This is a real cozy conversation.
Okay, my dears, that was our episode. I hope there was some practices that were helpful to you. I hope it was affirmative for you. If you want to be a dear heart, go give Carmen a message and thank her for sharing her generosity, pick up her book, take her classes, support her in all of the things. And I will be here with you next week. Same bat place, same bat time with an episode on spiritual crisis. Okay, be good to you. Be sweet to you. Be good to others. Be sweet to others. Until soon.